All right, it's April 25th, 2010. Scott Woods here from Toronto, continuing along with the Dobbs files / the Meltzer files, talking in person to Bob Dobbs in Maui. How you doing, Bob?
Great, Scott. I'm really enjoying this. I called information last night in Portland to see if Meltzer was listed, and he was. You know, he's there, Richard Meltzer, but his phone number's unlisted, so haven't got him yet. But
okay.
Trying to draw his attention to the wonderful thing I'm doing to his work. I'm going to make him famous.
Okay, well, I'm up for that. That sounds good, actually. So we'll work on that. I've been lazy on that front for sure. So, and we've been a little lax in keeping up with these episodes, but we'll just keep going as long as we can. Because of my situation, I tend to not always be able to come through each and every week or every 2 weeks, but we'll just keep going at it. I'm loving it. So I think today we do have some more pages we're going to go through. There's a section that I distributed to you where Meltzer goes quite heavily into the idea of cliches. Now, obviously when I came across this passage, the first thing that came to mind was McLuhan's book, From Cliché to Archetype, and do you want to maybe start with talking a little bit about what McLuhan says about that, or would you rather just dive into Meltzer and then just, if McLuhan obviously is going to come up, just sort of take it from there? How do you want to go into this?
I like reading Meltzer, so let's go into Meltzer, then I'll probably backtrack and give the context of McLuhan.
Sounds good, yeah, just because I do want some context for the McLuhan.
Yeah. I'll see what he says. I haven't read this before, and we're gonna. So that's what I meant when I'm gonna make Meltzer famous. I'm gonna take the cliche of Meltzer and archetypalize him. That's what these files are doing. So McLuhan relates the word cliche to archetype. So that's what we're gonna move towards. But let's see what Meltzer writes, because we're on page 173 of The Aesthetics of Rock, and I see the word cliche used a lot here in this paragraph. So he goes, there may be parts. A paragraph before may be relevant, but we're not going to go into there. We may come back to that. So we'll just start here, page 173, where he goes, okay, rock contextualizes everything. Now, what does contextualize mean? I'm not sure, so let's find out what he thinks he means. Rock contextualizes everything. But rock is also a matter of cliches. Cliches not just in reference, but cliches per se. That is, all art either manipulates cliches, in brackets, i.e. old or new past. Old or new passing as old, cultural ready-mades. There's a Duchamp thing, bracket. So that is, all art either manipulates cliches or turns, via the process of exposure to the public, its creation into cliches. Art is concerned with the overly familiar, what looks like the overly familiar, and with turning things into the overly familiar. But the ability and willingness to cognitively and non-cognitively deal with the cliché as the sole source of viscera, and as soul viscera itself, is rock's alone. Now, there's lots of great stuff already. I could go on this, but let's finish the paragraph. Disappearance of credibility and applicability. Now, I got to go back to this. Disappearance of credibility and applicability of the cliché on page 174. Yeah. The aesthetics of cliché manipulation in its sternest confrontation with mere belief and relevance comfort. Okay, so there's a cheeky, idiosyncratic phrase, relevance comfort. Cliché referred to, cliché understood and used, cliché just used, specific cliché just used in the midst of other clichés referred to and understood and used, cliché possibility / inevitability ignored at varying stages of the games, return of the previously inadequate / adequate as crystallized cliché, cliché relationships of cliché to cliché, the mere possibility of easy structural differentiation between the clichéd and the corny, in brackets the cliché is the approach to the neutralized corny without recourse to overstatement, end of bracket, cliché as ready-made, reliance on the cliché of ready-madeness, cliché of the non-cliché, cliché is the only level of avoidance of the just-once metaphor, cliché is unreflective, in brackets, or merely non-cognitive. Note, so he, non-cognitive means unreflective. So cognitive to means to him conceptualizing, sort of like a second look,
right,
where direct percept is non-cognitive or unreflective. So we've sort of got an equation here in the middle of this. Cliché is unreflective continuance of use, ancient versus recent cliche, something about the cliche of the cliche that goes further than the definition of the cliche. Cliche is trans-semantic endurance for semantic molecules. Cliche formation as the surface Cliche formation is the surface hyphen obvious hole with conceptualizations in the process of crystallization and as receptacles and media for containing the whole thing. It's as unavoidable as a mongoose. When it's musical, I got to go back. When it's musical, a repetition. When it's musical, a repetition orientation helps, and a repetition obsession is better best. Better hyphen best. When it's linguistic, all you have to do is open your mouth or think for a second or two. When it's linguistic, all you have to do is open your mouth and think for a second or two. When it's non-musically metalinguistic, all you have to do. When it's non-musically metalinguistic, all you have to do. You have to do all? Not okay. Sure about that.
It's a fragmented sentence.
Right. So, we go back. So that was that paragraph. Oh, quite a paragraph. But that reminds me, I'm going to read the footnotes at the bottom. He's saying relevance, comfort. Is that 155? Yeah. Relevance, comfort. Why not resignation to an assumed proposition of reality? The cliche rather than mere reality itself. You get both an assumed reality and an assumed substitute, plus the formal excitement of the formally unlikely, in brackets the logic of heaven rock, etc. Then the other footnote is after mongoose. I think that's what that is.
Yeah.
There is further an ambiguous multiplicity of actual cliche generation points. Whereas it is only a few days' familiarity that separates the artist qua cliché monger from the audience qua cliché recipient, after the moment of initial public exposure, the actual discrepancy of consciousness in relation to any set or level of specifics in the cliché market can be covered up by... got to go back here. Scott sent them. Can be covered up by the artist hiding in his present as a post-exposure past. Awareness of this time lapse can easily engender deeper, more direct cliche concern / disregard. Okay, so it doesn't have to be this complicated if he knew McLuhan, okay?
Right.
He's wallowing around in an effect that McLuhan is describing in the book from Cliched Archetype. So I guess we're going to have to see. I didn't know if we'd have to use McLuhan, but obviously this is gibberish. Unless you have a wider framework or a context, let's contextualize this with McLuhan's theme from Cliched Archetype, which book came out in 1970, but he started writing it with Wilford Roth Watson in like 62, 63, quite early, just as Understanding Media was coming out in 64.
Would he have had stuff out there about it? About, like, the concept of cliché?
No.
Okay.
There's no indication of it unless you were one of his colleagues getting letters.
Colleagues, yeah.
Yeah, you can see that. It's mainly letters with Wilford Watson. He was keeping it. It's just really between him. And Hot McLuhan Hot and Cool, which comes out in 67, mm-hmm. There's an essay by Howard Gossage.
Right.
And he's the advertising genius who promoted McLuhan. And what was interesting, I found out from Mary McLuhan, McLuhan's daughter, that while Gossage was promoting McLuhan, McLuhan's daughter had to live with Mr. Gossage and his wife because she had hitchhiked to San Francisco from Banff in 65 or so and had no job. So Marshall told her to look him up, and so she went and knocked on the door, and he brought her in, and she stayed there while she got a job as an editor at Vogue magazine and started swinging in the San Francisco scene. So she has a whole... Not many people know much about Gossage. He was famous in advertising, and people in the industry knew him, but I don't know much written about him except for this one thing I saw recently, but I haven't had a chance to read it. But Mary knew Gossage, you know, in detail, and Gossage's widow is one of her best friends. So that's an interesting aspect of the McLuhan biographies that could have come out if they had gotten in touch with Mary. But Mary was not in touch with Marchand in Toronto and these Canadian guys because she had lost contact with Toronto, you know, 30 years ago.
Right.
Since, you know, she's been a Californian since the mid-60s. But that's a side thing. Gossage says, now I always remember this when I read it, when the book came out in 67, he said, he just threw this in at the end of his little essay on McLuhan. He said, McLuhan said that a new technology or a new phenomenon is the last word. It's the last word, which is a cliche slang thing for saying, you know, hey, this is where it's at. This is great. This is the last word on this. It's the state of art, state of the art, right?
Right, right.
So a new environment is the last word. Then it becomes a cliche after everybody's used to it for a while. And then it becomes an art form. And then it becomes an archetype. And that was the first time I ever saw those four phases laid out in relation to McLuhan. He certainly wasn't talking to me or any of his friends, or I wasn't a close colleague of his. It's only the guys he's writing a book with that got this stuff. And mainly it was just Watson and his wife, Sheila Watson, who is a great figure in Canadian female literature. You know, first postmodern female writer that Margaret Atwood and everybody was inspired by. So, and she wrote her thesis on Wyndham Lewis, which was pretty incredible, under McLuhan's guidance. So the Watsons were really intellectual equals, almost, of McLuhan, you know. So I've read Sheila Watson's letters back in 2008. They were just released in St. Michael's College, and it's incredible the correspondence that McLuhan has with her, because she was an English prof, so he could discuss his most intimate, you know, insights about Finnegan's Wake and that, and you get them in his letters to Sheila. So he's corresponding with Sheila and Wilford about this cliche stuff, and you can see him thinking it out with Wilford. That's all I know, and I don't know. He must have mentioned it to Howard Gossies, because Gossies came up with this pattern.
Okay.
You go from last word to cliche to art to archetype. So archetype is older, richer, deeper than art. So you read that in 67, and then out comes the book in 1970 from cliche to archetype. And it says on the cover, McLuhan says that it's the way more important than understanding media, and it's a great work, and he loves it, and he's really proud of it. And most people never read it and didn't understand it. So you look at understanding media, that's studying the effects of television in the 50s. It's basically dealing with the TV effect. There is a chapter on automation, a little bit about the satellite, but it's almost like understanding media is a rearview mirror image of the 50s, turning the 50s into art form as a TV effect, because the hidden ground, the real new operation, was the satellite environment. So understanding
understanding media is organized into chapters, you know, like there's a chapter on the telephone, the printing press.
33 chapters paralleling the 33 degrees of Freemasonry.
Okay, but is it looking at those through the lens of television? Is that
it's looking at that television turned America into a tactile culture, and so it's looking at previous cultures as either acoustic bias or visual bias. It's doing it from the framework of tactility, which television retrieved and extended.
Okay.
And now what's happening when the book comes out is actually the satellite environment, which is turning tactile media, visual media, and acoustic media into art forms as content of the global theater caused by the satellite. All right? Okay. So understanding media is an art form. It's retrieving the book with a perspective of the satellite effect as a hidden agenda, but he doesn't talk about that. He just talks about TV mainly. So then by 1970, the digital world's starting to come in. You've got those computers hooked up between UCLA, Stanford, and some other place, Salt Lake City. Four of them set up in September 69. And that's the beginning of the building of the Internet, okay? Computers talking to each other. And that's in 69. So outcomes from cliche to archetype. That means that the digital, or what I call the Android meme environment, is now becoming major ground. So the figure is no longer television. It's the most recent previous environment, the satellite.
Right,
so the
right.
satellite environment is the content of the Android meme. And so the process of all media being art forms inside the global theater has turned over so much by 1970 that now we're going to look at the turnover of the turning thing from last word to cliche to art to archetype. That process is now stated in the book from cliche to archetype, because we're moving in the Android meme. So the satellite environmental effect from things going from cliche to archetype is now a figure in a book. So that's why he said his book was from cliche to archetype was way more important than understanding media. It's because it describes the 60s, whereas understanding media describes the 50s. Okay?
Right, okay.
Okay, now what's really amazing, I'm going to go into this a little bit more. You will see that what Meltzer's trying to write about is the effect of every media expression, every previous media environment, which at one point was the last word. You know, when the printing press came in, that was the last word. Then by, you know, 100 years, by 1600, the book is a cliche, right?
Right.
And then when the newspaper comes in, it obsolesces the book. The newspaper is the last word, and so it turns the book from cliche into art form. And that's when you start getting novels, say 1750, okay?
Yeah.
Joseph Fielding and those guys. Novels. There's occasional novel here and there, way back. They're a freak accident. But novels as a culture becomes a big thing. That's turning the printed book into art form. So then when you get into the electric age, say the radio era, it turns the newspaper into art form, and it turns the book into archetype because it's older, been around longer. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So right when radio comes in, you have the book archetypalized by Joyce with Ulysses, which is all about being the greatest novel, the all book, the ever book. You know, it can, has all these themes. It's the greatest Menippean satire, and then Finnegan's Wake is a step past that. So let's see. So when you get this process of a new technology comes in, it's the last word, it's not a cliche, but after a while it gets used and it becomes a cliche. We see that, you know, this is Warhol's statement, everybody becomes famous for 15 minutes. He's beginning to see the cliche, the last word then becoming a cliche. I don't know if he understood that cliches became archetypes, but he did do that in his art. He took the cliches of Hollywood, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, Marilyn Monroe, and made them archetypal by putting them in the museum. And the museum is the agency of archetypalization.
Right, so that's almost like a classic.
Become a classic. Archetype is becoming a classic.
Okay, and I was going to say, and Warhol's version is, it's almost like a classic case study of what you're talking about, really.
Oh, yeah, well, Meltzer and Warhol were archetypalizing here. I mean, Warhol's totally understandable in the larger framework that McLuhan provides. Why Warhol became famous? He became obsolete, then he became art form when all those guys, Marco Costabi and those guys, imitated the Warhol factory in the 80s, the postmodernist artists, and then he becomes archetype, where he's a huge foundation and he wrote his own, one of his own books is The Pope of American Art. He knew he was an archetype. But that's all within the cultures of our industry, and puny compared to the larger operations of media dynamics. I mean, American Idol is now archetype.
Right.
So what's the matter? It doesn't matter if you're an archetype. And this is partly what Meltzer's getting at. So once we understand what I'm talking about, it'll make total sense. Like, I never read this before, but as I read it, I said to myself, oh, this is perfect illustration of the global theater effect that McLuhan's talking about. Because here's the thing, is as you have this turnover of something becoming, being new, last word, then it's, everybody's used to it, it's cliche, but then it's retrieved when a new environment comes in. So people, for example, the new wave cinema in the 50s, the French directors, the auteurs, they, A-U-T-E-U-R-S, they redid the famous movies of the 30s and 40s in American culture and redid them as an art form.
Right, exactly, yeah, another classic example, yeah.
And it's a classic process. Everybody can even understand that. It's almost the same on a mini, on a tiny level. The French make a big deal out of Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Okay, so the French, McLuhan said that in TV culture, when TV came in, what was the content of TV? It was movies, the late night movie, the late movie. And because it's the old environment, it's cliche, but it comes back as art form when you have television. Okay?
Yeah.
So you actually are moving into satellite effect, the computer effect in the later 50s. That turns TV into an art form and the movie into archetype. See, so each medium falls back to a larger category, right?
Yeah.
So McLuhan said, and this is really interesting, when the phonetic alphabet comes in and peaks and gets crystallized in Greece at the time of Athens, Plato is taking the spoken word, which was an old medium and an old environment, it's now the content of the visualization of the phonetic alphabet or writing, so therefore what does speech become? It becomes an art form, and that's Plato's Symposium. A bunch of people talking, and the reader gets great archetypal significance out of it because it's an old environment. You see what I mean?
Right.
It's speech as art form.
And the book makes it?
Then the book makes speech archetype.
Right. Okay, yeah, that's what I was grasping.
And the content of the printed book is Greece and Rome, the early writings of the phonetic culture, geometry, the classics, oratory, you know, Virgil, Dante, all that stuff, rare manuscripts, becomes the art form inside the printing press. And Plato becomes, as speech, becomes archetype. So that's the pattern here. You got a new, let's look at it this way. Zappa is new environment, the last word in the 60s. In the 70s, he becomes an art form. By the 80s, he can go on Johnny Carson and say that he's a national treasure, meaning he's getting to archetypal levels. But that's not for everybody. It's just for in the rock world. By the 80s, Zappa is considered a gray eminence. You know what I mean? You could call that art form, but he's moving towards archetype, definitely by now. So you can see, now that's happening in every field, in every entertainment thing, because in the global theater, you got so much media, like a laundromat, which is an ending image in Finnegan's Wake, a laundromat's churning, soaking, rinsing. McLuhan used to use that phrase, soak, rinse, and something else. You know, the washing machine cycle. All the media are being turned over rapidly by the mid-60s. So the cliché to archetype process becomes obvious, and McLuhan's the first to see it. In other words, the process from going last word to cliché or obsolete to art form to archetype, the people are groping through it, and but McLuhan sees it on a larger level and faster. So take the Beatles. The Beatles in the English Invasion, what did they do? They replayed the 50s Chuck Berry stuff.
Yep.
You got the global theater, which is going to turn. The satellite comes in, Sputnik, and then Telstar in 62, and then by the mid-60s, the satellite, the big environment, and the Apollo, and the figure for that is the Apollo moon program, okay? But everybody's looking at a rocket going to the moon. That's a visual point of view project. There's the resonant effect of satellites and communications going around the planet that nobody's noticing. They don't show every satellite going up and make a big fanfare out of it like they do every moon launch or Apollo launch.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so in the middle of that, that means music and even tactile TV, books, movies, all the entertainment media, including speech, are at least art form by the middle 60s. So within pop music, which is a new phenomenon of electric media itself, starting with jazz and Frank Sinatra and then Elvis, you know, very broad terms, but you know what it means. It's a whole genre. So what do the Beatles do? They replay music itself, and they're not music. They are multimedia. Elvis was music. Okay, he was a singer.
Yeah.
He got moved into movies, and that's because he had to move out of music. But the Beatles were totally created by Brian Epstein, almost like the Sex Pistols, you know, Malcolm... What's his name?
Well, that's Malcolm McLaren, but I mean that's a contentious point about the Beatles, I think. But go on with
no, you. They're meeting a felt
Brian
need.
Epstein created. I don't think Brian Epstein created the Beatles, but
no, he understood that he saw that they were destined for some kind of popularity, and then he cleaned them up so that they were acceptable into the AM radio world.
Right.
Okay, so it's an early manipulation. I mean, even Colonel Parker did it with Elvis.
That's true. It was a manipulation, and yeah, Lennon certainly spoke of that, and they had to wait a couple years to be able to, like, get out of the suits and stuff like that.
Right. So let's look at, Elvis is the individual American archetype of a unique singer. Okay, that's individual creativity. That's that. The satellite comes in by 1960, and you're going to get a massive collectivization or hive mind, but not only among people, but within media themselves. And so, isn't it interesting the Beatles, they are four. It's not an individual. It's a team. It's a team as a singing operation.
It's a group.
It's a group mind. And the other factor McLuhan pointed out, it was the first time the street accent, the Liverpudlian accent or the Cockney accent, was allowed in major popularity.
Right.
So it's almost like a hyper celebration of the working man or the working class, because everybody's equalized by this global theater. So everybody's going left wing and Mao's popular, all this hive mind and no individuality. So here are the Beatles. And I remember people back then saying, nah, Elvis was better than the Beatles. That's for, they couldn't be doing anything by themselves, you know. Elvis could do it by himself. And so there was all this individualist kind of person have identity crisis over this four anonymous shaggy guys that look like each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so the rednecks and the hard rockers couldn't take that. So you have this, it's totally, the Beatles are more than the music. And what it is, they're expressing the emotion of multitude that really gets hyped up when you got all media and you got radio, TV, and movie, and their collective emotion of multitude, electric media themselves, you have them clashing together inside the hidden ground of the global satellite, the global theater. There's nothing but all you need is love is the kind of emotion that's going to come out of that. And that's a human scale emotion, trying to maintain the human level while it's being wiped out by the beginning of the android meme. So the whole great feeling of human community, represented by the Beatles and the pop culture of the mid-60s, well, you know, which generations now still romanticize, was the final grasp of the chemical body as we moved into the digital discarded android meme phenomenon. Okay, so the Beatles, they eventually put out the White Album and the Yellow Submarine. They replay a lot of the music of the whole 20th century. Do you know what I mean?
And absolutely.
They play with it. They are a prime example of taking cliches. And if Meltzer wrote this paragraph before the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper's or the White Album, that's pretty interesting. But maybe he wrote it after. You know what I mean? Because he's
You never know. It's somewhere, anywhere within that time frame.
So since
I would say it's probably before, like it's probably, I would assume this is probably around 66, 67, but yeah, hard to say.
Yeah, so he,
it was when Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, so he, being an intelligent, receptive mind, is picking up the process that the Beatles are going to act out musically, about playing with cliches.
Yeah.
The cliches from all the different kinds of styles of Tin Pan Alley, so to speak. So you see within the Beatles, they're turning over cliches. Now let's go back to the McLuhan level, where you got the global theater, where TV is being recycled, movies are being recycled, this hyperabundance of software, entertainment's happening. Okay, so I saw McLuhan give a lecture about 1974 when someone said to him, you know, you got the book becoming art form, and someone had read Cliche Archetype, was just a student, and he crudely said what I've been saying. He said, so the book becomes an art form, and then the movie becomes an archetype. He was trying to say that, and this was at York University someplace, and McLuhan says, oh, that's happened many times over. And that was a clue to me that it was happening faster than what Howard Gossage said in 67, quoting McLuhan. Okay. The process of going last word, obsolete, art form, and an archetype, as Zappa said, you got a new fad, a new emotional multitude every 18 months. So that those four phases happen that fast. Whereas the book took 500 years to go from last word, the printed book, to a cliche, to art form, to archetype. 500 years. That process takes 18 months by 1970. So you see how important it is what McLuhan was trying to say. And then you get into the subtleties. He says, you did not have an art form idea until visual space was put around as a new environment. So when writing and the phonetic alphabet came in at the time of Plato, the first art form was created, speech as art form. That's Plato's dialogues. Tribal societies don't have art. They just try to do everything as well as possible, and there's no difference. Okay, just everybody...
Yeah.
And it's definitely not art as a consumer commodity until the printing press comes in. So what was I saying? So the...
Forget before the art is everything.
Yeah, I was talking about the art... Oh, yeah, archetype. So to turn something into an art form, McLuhan in his writing starts to blur archetype and art form. So they become interchangeable, so that the speech became art form or archetypal with the Greek Plato's writings. You can say it's art form in Plato's time. Then with the printing press, speech becomes archetypal. And as I read the notes to McLuhan's, his personal notes on what he had to say about writing, understanding media. When I did his archives, I came across this little note, and he said, this book is archetypalizing speech. So he's taking understanding media and saying he's archetypalizing speech. That's already been happening with the printing press, but he's going to retrieve that process by writing a book. And when you write a book by 1965 or 64, it's archetypalizing speech. So it's very interesting how what he's saying about that in his notes to understanding media. So all these were clues for me to understand really what was going on in Klesia archetype. So when you have visual space, a framework, that turns something into an art form. Pre-literate cultures don't have art forms. So only in Western literate societies do you even have the process of art form. And then when you turn over several environments, like printing press and movies and that, you have the archetypalization of the art form. So McLuhan says archetype is a product of visual culture. Cliché is not. Cliché is what pre-literate people and post-literate people do. They have their daily life, and they repeat it so much, it's like a ritual, that it becomes the art form, but it's not art form like we do as archetype. It's not visualized. It's just a ritualization process, and that is cliché as archetype. Now he takes that point about tribal people archetypalizing cliché, and he says that's what's happening in the 60s under the satellite conditions, where the whole humanity is not only tribalized but made discarnate and super individualized. You have nothing but cliché, and cliché as archetype, but not literate archetype, another kind of archetype of heavy involvement in the image, which is what you have today, and what Warhol said, everybody becomes famous for 15 minutes. Remember what Warhol said in the 70s, he changed it. He said, in 15 minutes, everyone will be famous.
Right, right.
So he's archetypalizing the emotion of multitude. That is a cliché process, a ritual process, by 1970. So then you look at the distinction between cliché and archetype, how archetype is not possible. When you get a post-literate society, you can only have cliché as being archetypalized. So when you read the introduction to McLuhan's From Cliché to Archetype, he spells this out. He talks about the literate basis of archetype. And remember, Scott and I, in my dialogues with Scott with my book, Fatic Communion, I go a lot of, in the McLuhan section, I do a lot of the quotes on cliché to archetype, and I go through this and I explain that only in literate cultures do you have archetype. See, that's the limitations of Carl Jung. He's talking about the psychic archetype, and he doesn't know that's a product of literacy. McLuhan did, so McLuhan said that technological environments are archetypes, not some psychic process. That's a real great challenge to Freud and Jung and Ken Wilber and all the other idiots who deal with just literacy and don't even know the effect. So anyways, McLuhan revolutionizes the meaning of archetype. So since you can't have archetype in the post-literate society, you can only have cliché as an intense involving ritual. It's sort of like archetype, but it can't be a literate sense. Now, look at what I'm saying about cliché becoming archetype, the cliché process becoming archetype, and let's reread Meltzer, and it makes total sense. Since everything in the 60s, you're listening to archetypal jazz, new rock, new hard rock, all that experience on radio, all those movies you're going to, all those books you're going to, all those scenes you see when you drive your car all over the place, look right at the multimedia environment that the average North American person is having. The only way you can begin to discuss any pattern in it is the cliché to archetype process. So, after, you sort of say, get in the late 70s, when you start to get mixed media, where the Beatles are making movies, Dennis Hopper is making
the late 60s, right? Okay.
Yeah, the late 60s is what they call the counterculture takes off. It's actually an individual artist hijacking all different media. I mean, you saw that in the 70s when David Bowie jumped from medium to medium, right?
Right, right.
Now, that's the content going through this churning and hopping from genre to genre, media. But the media forms themselves, the environmental implications and their effects, are turning over rapidly under the satellite environment. So on one level, you've got the, McLuhan stayed on the big formal level. He didn't get too involved in content. He could just categorize the content. But he was saying, what happens when satellite becomes an archetype? And he actually says this in 1962. He says, TV is rapidly becoming archetype. Now, no one even knows what he means by that, because it's, you know, 8 years before cliche archetype. And if you happen to read Howard Gossage's thing in 1967, you'd see, oh, it goes from last word to cliche to art form to archetype. And so when I was looking back reading the late 50s and early 60s articles by McLuhan's where he's talking about the satellite effect, he actually says TV's not an art form. He says it's an archetype. Now that's way before, you know, it's way beyond what anybody's noticing. So, but if TV's art archetype, that means satellite by 67 is art form. And what's the hidden ground? What's the last word? The digital, the Android meme. So you can see how I was on top of all this stuff once I understood that pattern. Okay, and that's why, now here is Meltzer, and we've only got another 10 or 15 minutes, but you'll see Meltzer sticking with the word cliche and showing variations. It's like the Eskimo having 50 kinds of snow, Meltzer's perceiving 50 kinds of cliche. Now, if he knew the archetypal process, if he knew the literate archetypal phase that McLuhan laid out, he could distinguish all these phrases, types of cliches, and do it better. But overall, because you can't have archetypes in the satellite, post-literate, tribal, discarnate environment, you can only have cliches and turnover of cliches, or what McLuhan said, the rise and fall of cliches. And it got to the point by 1980, there was such a turnover that if you had fallen as a famous cliche, that helped you be retrieved. You know, the worst reputation, you know, nowadays you kill your mother to become famous, right? And then you become a quick last word, and then obsolete, and then an art form and cliche, and then you end up, what, if you're an archetype, you usually ended up interviewed in Interview magazine by Andy Warhol. You know what I mean? And then you'd be part of New York High Society or something. So let's look at the way he overuses the word cliche, and he's trying to describe the very thing that McLuhan laid out. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like meta. Cliche goes, if a cliche goes to art form, then the art form goes to archetype. You might also, you know, when he says archetype and art form are indistinguishable by the 60s, that's because the archetype was a literate phase, and you can't even have a literate phase in a post-literate society, so art form and archetype become interchangeable in the global theater. Whereas you were back 150 years ago, archetype is one phase, it's a slower technological time, and art forms another phase. They blur. So when you read McLuhan in the late 60s, early 70s, he's mixing archetype and art form. And he's not telling you that there's a phase before that where there's different. But it is totally correct to interplay archetype, to blur the lines between archetype and art form, because everything is made a cliche pretty rapidly in the global theater situation. So with that all said, look at the word cliche with these four levels involved. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Last word, because now here's what McLuhan says, the final formula from cliche archetype. He says, since you have such a turnover of archetypes and cliches by 1970, you have old archetype becomes new cliche, and new cliche becomes old archetype. They start flipping, even cliche and archetype. So maybe you don't get it. You don't get it immediately, but this flipping of archetype and cliche is what Meltzer is trying to describe.
Okay.
So let's go back and watch this. He's going to talk about how McLuhan says the chapter titles in the book from Cliche Archetype are like cliche as double probe, cliche as new archetype. He's playing with this and showing that, let's say, American Pie, Don McLean comes out with American Pie. He's just a folk singer, one song, and it becomes almost archetypal within a year.
Right.
And I still hear people who think American Pie is a great song. But it just, I was tracking it back then, 1970 or so. It lasted about 6 months, and that was it. But it had a big effect, but it was also resonating with the baby boomers, because Woodstock had happened, Kent State had happened, and everybody thought the whole 60s had died. And that was partly what was resonating in that song, right?
Right.
So it was a great pattern, the song, had great impact, but disappeared because of the turnover of the cliché to archetype process. And so you'd have someone like Phoebe Snow come along in the 80s and say, I think Don McLean is a forgotten artist. You know, he was a great artist and everybody forgot him. She's complaining about the cliché the hyper-clicheing process and obsolescence, but by the 80s, she's archetypalizing Don McLean.
Right.
Okay, so it's all, in simpler terms, it's all trying to find value. What are the values? What's valuable? What is meaningful as an experience? So this is what he's wrestling with, and it's kind of sloppy. Once you know McLuhan, this is very sloppy what he's doing, because McLuhan says it better and doesn't have to go on with two pages of punning on the word cliche, because he's showing the dynamics. The problem with what Meltzer's doing here is not showing how the electric environment and satellite environment caused this perception of everything becoming transitory cliches, and then retrieve cliches to be temporary new cliches, okay? Well, he should say becoming new temporary archetypes.
Right, okay, but that's putting him, like, fully into a framework of Bob and McLuhan. So what do you think he is trying to actually do?
Well, I think he...
That framework would not have been part of his own context.
That's right. And now here's what he's doing. As a sensitive mind, a quote genius, picking up on the pattern, he's in New York City and able to see the latest things, he is actually, he's an example, what McLuhan said, an artist is a figure for a hidden ground that's affecting everybody. And an artist has a particular take on it that becomes a big deal. He is tuned in and describing the process that everybody's experiencing. And so when he says rock contextualizes everything, he's saying that the word, McLuhan said, we lived entirely by music in the global theater. The word makes the market. That word was musical. That's rock. Rock on the content level is the hidden ground. People are all digging whatever the music is, and they're getting meaning out of it. That's why rock criticism developed. People found archetypal experiences in the ear. In the ear was archetypalized. So that rock doesn't really contextualize everything. The satellite environment does, but that's too big. Meltzer can't see that. He's inside the satellite effect. He's only young, so he's got an alibi. Maybe now he could get it. But for him, and it's true, and for most people, the rock, the word that makes the market, is the framework that everything's judged by. Everybody judges whether, you know, by compare themselves to the Beatles. Everybody compares themselves to Jefferson Airplane, then Sex Pistols, then whatever, and disco, and then whatever happened in the 80s. You know, you run out of who are they? It was Eminem 8 years ago, so who is it today? Lady Gaga. She contextualizes everything, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that, what that means is that's the anthropomorphic projection. Oh, there's still human beings making songs. Okay, there must be still be human beings here. So human beings contextualize everything on the McLuhan level. The human image, when everything is discarnate. So he says, okay, rock contextualizes everything. But rock is also a matter of cliches. And what is rock? It's an environment made up of visuals and acoustic and photographic images. The whole mixed media are all cliches inside the satellite environment. So that's technically right. It's a matter of cliches, right?
Yeah.
It's mixed media. Cliches not just in reference, like referring back to literary points. That's actually an archetype. So you say not just cliche as archetype, but cliches per se. And cliches per se is any content does on the radio. We need content so people can have the radio experience. So cliche becomes probe and new energy. It becomes the last word. That's what he means by cliches per se. Okay? That is all art. Now, he jumps into art, and that's good. Cliche is art. Retrieval of that process. That is, all art either manipulates cliches, i.e. old or new passing is old, totally appropriate statement when things are happening every 18 months, right? New passing is old, cultural ready-mades. Okay, that is all art either manipulates cliches or turns its creation into cliches via the process of exposure to the public. So what is every art becomes a public operation with the printing press. It's not a public operation as a commodity. In the medieval period, they didn't have art. Art was for the aristocrats when somebody drew a portrait, and usually it was religious stuff. So right. The art of the public in the medieval time was the maypole and seasonal festivals. That was a... So, rock, Altamont, Woodstock are seasonal festivals. So think of the... We retrieve cliche medieval sensibility in the 60s. So when he says art either manipulates cliches, that's commodity art, printing press art, paintings and music and poetry and literature. It takes the cliches from a new super information environment that starts to come in with the printing press, and then, you know, congested cities, and then you have the media of the 20th century, and art, you might mean painting, takes these cliches from other media and puts it in the museum. And the museum is a repository of literate values or the archetypalizing process.
Right, right. Okay.
So Warhol archetypalized media processes by being an artist and putting it in a museum, and that's the last artist, as Baudrillard says. And he said he was a machine. So he was showing the very process McLuhan says, which is a machinic process of turnover from last word, cliche, art form to archetype. He was turning that over and showing how the media environment was doing it automatically. So he was being an artist as a machine. So he was taking the new, passing as old, cultural ready-made. So that's even more complex. When you become old, you're on the way to becoming an art form in the four stages of McLuhan. So the i.e. old or new, passing as old, McLuhan used to say the new is now old and the old is now new. All this new-old stuff, literary categories, get really blurred once you're in the global theater, okay? And that's what he's trying to say.
New, passing as old, I find very confusing, though. I mean, the more obvious sort of flipping of that.
No, that's what Warhol did. Warhol would just film his factory, put it on film, and then claim it's art. And something is only art when it's old, because it's been around. It's gone through the last word. You get it?
Right, okay.
I mean, it's complex, it's confusing, because he's got it like 80% right. But he doesn't have to mix it up as much, therefore confusing the reader. But it's good training to be able to understand his confusion or to understand what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
Like it's like when you understand how to read Finnings Wake, you really are perceptive. You understand a lot of processes. So understanding Meltzer is a sign of pretty good perception. So he says, art is concerned with the overly familiar, what looks like the overly familiar. Now see, what the problem is that, what is art here? It could be movies, TV, radio, any of these media, or it could be a painting or someone speaking. It's too vague the way he uses art, because he hasn't figured out that art is techne, T-E-C-H-N-E, acute accent. That is what the postmodernists now have decided, and McLuhan was onto that in the 60s. Anything humans make is art. So you can see art is concerned with the older familiar. Yeah, anything humans do is usually familiar, but it's a little off. He's oscillating between the archetypal. He's trying to find the archetype, the literate archetype, in a post-literate environment. So he goes, art is concerned with the overly familiar, but new art isn't. New art is always ugly. So it's a bit mixed up here. Actually, rock is ugly to people in mid-60s because it's the new art. Art is the cliche per se. Right? Okay. So what looks like the overly familiar, so art is concerned with the overly familiar, what looks like the overly familiar, that would be new, passing as old, and with turning things into the overly familiar. Now, he's talking about the avant-garde art thing, the commodity mainstream art process, and classical art. He's mixing it all up here. But the ability and willingness to cognitively and non-cognitively, cognitively means conceptually, and non-cognitively, perceptually, you do both. You think and you perceive when there's so much media going on. You think a little bit, but you're also just doing perceptual response. So, but the ability and willingness to conceptually and perceptually deal with the cliché, and the cliché in this sense is anything that's happening. Tomorrow, you read the news, or whatever it is, that's cliché, because we're so beyond that in the digital evaporation of everything that just thinking something is a cliché act.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about earlier, because you were talking about how the process speeded up so much by the time McLuhan was even talking about it and before anyone, you know, virtually anyone else even recognized this pattern. But where are we at now? Is that what you're just saying there right now?
About we're going to have to get into where we're at now, the next thing, because I got to end in 2 minutes. Okay. So here's, I'm just going to the next sentence. But the ability and willingness to deal with the cliche as a sole source of viscera and as sole viscera itself is rocks alone. Now, this is very interesting. McLuhan says that the electric age gets you in the guts. Okay, he said this in an argument with W.H. Auden in Toronto in 1971. It's a famous thing. And McLuhan is saying, this old classical poet, Auden, W.H. Auden, doesn't understand the TV gets you in the guts. It's not a visual experience. So that's your viscera, your internal. It's the interior landscape. And it could touch the proprioceptive and the tactile. So here is Meltzer discussing the perceptual tactile effect, which is becoming an art form almost, because that's TV and that's the 50s. So in the 60s, it's the figure. So tactility is the viscera, is the thing people are looking for in the entertainment. And the only thing that can do that fast enough and loud enough is rock. So he's saying that rock is the relevant art because it's tactile. But he's calling it viscera, which is good, which is useful, because tactile is not a sense. That's an interplay. So the closest sense to tactility is the proprioceptive, the inner thing that's looking for balance and feeling itself and feeling its inner comfort. That can be expressed by the term viscera. So it's technically a correct point when he says, but the ability and willingness to deal with cliché, in other words, the larger effect of the word makes the market, and the satellite global theater effect, the larger environment, your friends are going to Vietnam and they're drafted and doing this and that, all those things that the baby boomers are doing in the mid-60s, what is the art that's the most proprioceptive and visceral that immediately deals with your problems every day? It's rock.
Yeah.
And it's the only one that can do it. So it is the... it's the anesthetic, and cliche archetype is anesthetic. It's a value, a big value, like God's an archetype. So Christianity has that archetypal comfort for people. And that's why we'll jump forward to that phrase, comfort relevance. And I end there. With what I've said, you understand what comfort relevance is. And so rock is comfort relevance.
Okay.
So... that's great. Try to listen to this again before we do our next session, because we're going to pick up from right here the disappearance of credibility and applicability. It's all totally obvious when you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, the sentence, but the ability and willingness to deal with the cliché is the sole source of viscera, and the sole viscera itself is rock stone. That the way you've laid that out makes a lot of sense to me. But I'm definitely lost following that. So yeah, that's where we'll pick it up.
Yeah, let me say this, that... the ability and willingness to deal with the cliché is a source of viscera. Everything is cliché in the post-literate satellite environment. Okay? So to deal with the fact that everything is cliché, disappearance of credibility and applicability, as a sole source of feeling you've got proprioceptive tactility happening in you, it's the human chemical body grasping for straws to see if it can still feel anything. Rock is the only thing that is the only cliché environment that can give you that intense archetypal experience in the tribal sense. Okay, I'm leaving it at that.
Sounds good, Bob. I know you got something else to do, so we'll pick it up.
Yeah, this is great stuff to break this down. It's never been heard by humanity ever before.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, Bob, we'll hopefully talk soon.
Okay, bye.